Hello there, Peabody here. Once again, it is time to take another revealing peek back into history.
What famous date shall I set it to today, Mr. Peabody?
All the way back to 2008. Ruination, the early years.
So if you are sitting there listening to this right now, I want you to just try to visualize a goldfish in a bowl.
Okay, a goldfish.
Yeah, you have this incredibly small, you know, perfectly contained, highly regulated little ecosystem.
Right, the water level is exact.
Exactly. Yeah. And the little plaque castle is always in the exact same spot day after day.
And the temperature is strictly controlled.
Yeah. So now I want you to imagine picking up that glass bowl, walking right out your front door, getting on a cross-country flight, and setting that exact same bowl down in the middle of, I don't know, a pulsing, chaotic, neon-lit nightclub.
Oh, wow. Okay. That is quite the visual.
Right. The environment surrounding the bowl has completely radically changed. I mean, the sensory input is overwhelming.
Yeah, the lighting is totally different. The noise is deafening, sure.
And the predictable rhythms of the domestic world are just gone. But inside that bowl,
the water level hasn't shifted a single millimeter.
Not one millimeter. The goldfish is still just swimming its usual laps, you know, viewing this absolute anarchy through the exact same curved glass. I am King.
And I am Gail.
And we want to officially welcome you to another week of Ruination. The early years.
We are your guides on this ongoing, highly detailed journey through the massive archival source material of the Big Fatty Online universe.
Yes, we are. And today we are bringing you a deep dive into a very specific, I guess you could call it a volatile moment in this timeline.
Very volatile. The temporal stage is set in mid-July of 2008.
Right, 2008. And we are examining a single uninterrupted week of content spanning episodes 117 through 121.
And the mission today is to dissect exactly what happens when that goldfish bowl goes on vacation.
Yes. We are looking at the jarring but honestly highly entertaining collision between Big Fatty's unscripted vacation chaos in California.
And the rigid, non-negotiable 20-minute daily structure of his audio journal.
Exactly. Because he refuses to change for anything.
No, he really doesn't. And that goldfish analogy perfectly establishes the stakes of this specific week.
I thought it fit pretty well.
It does. Because what we're really analyzing here is the severe tension between two absolute extremes of existence.
Right, the two poles of his life.
Yeah, so on one side, you have the stability of what he calls the fat cave.
Ah, yes, the legendary fat cave.
Which is his home base, you know. It's the controlled environment where the microphone sits at the correct angle, the routine is established, and the daily broadcast is just a reliable function of his domestic life.
Right, it's predictable, it's safe.
Completely. But then on the other side, you have the utter unpredictability of Palm Springs.
You know, pure chaos.
Yeah. And the tension between these two states, the deep-seated desire for routine versus the unavoidable reality of travel, well, that's the narrative engine driving this entire archival block.
It really is. I mean, he is taking his highly distinct, unwavering personality, his strict 20-minute format, and dropping it into a completely foreign environment.
And because he absolutely refuses to change the format of his show, the environment itself has to bend to his will.
It has to. And the disruption of his routine begins almost immediately. I mean, he does not waste a single second establishing this new reality.
None at all.
We are introduced very early on to the concept of PPNPS.
PPNPS.
Which, I mean, sounds like some sort of secure government clearance, right?
It really does sound like a military operation.
Right. But in this universe, it stands for Podcasting Poolside in Palm Springs.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. So he is broadcasting from outside his hotel room at the Helios. And just by taking the show out of the fat cave, he instantly injects this massive wave of sensory friction into the audio.
Yeah, and to really grasp the weight of this, you have to put yourself in a 2008 mindset.
That's a great point. The tech was so different.
It was a crucial piece of context. In 2008, the technological friction of podcasting on the road was, well, it was significant.
Oh, totally. Today, you could just sit by a pool with a smartphone.
Exactly. And built-in AI software would isolate your voice and completely erase the sound of a splashing fountain or a passing car.
Like it wasn't even there.
But back then, capturing audio meant dealing with the physical reality of your surroundings.
Which he hated.
Oh, he despised it. He explicitly tells the listener that he had to abandon his usual high-quality snowflake microphone.
Because the ambient poolside sounds would just completely overload the recording.
Right. Instead, he has to capture the raw, unfiltered audio of his environment using whatever basic tech he brought with him.
Just a total nightmare for him.
So he steps outside and immediately, rather than, you know, actually relaxing on his vacation, he becomes locked in a bitter environmental battle.
And the nature of that battle is fascinating to me because he completely ignores the obvious narrative.
What do you mean?
Well, he notes that the high for the day is a staggering 105 degrees.
Which is incredibly hot.
Right. But for a man raised in the deep American South, 105 degrees in the arid desert is practically a cold front.
Oh, that's true. The lack of humidity changes things.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He casually dismisses the heat, calling it, quote, very cool for Palm Springs.
Wow. Very cool.
Yeah. So the temperature is not the antagonist of this trip. The true enemy, the thing he fixates on with an almost obsessive intensity, is the relative humidity.
Of course it is.
He is just baffled that the locals are complaining about the humidity reaching 55%.
Because to him, that's nothing.
It's a dry day. He takes this mundane weather report and dramatically informs his audience that back in Charleston, South Carolina, when the humidity hits a mere 55%, his, quote, lips are chapped.
His lips are chapped at 55% humidity. That is amazing.
Right. He weaponizes the humidity to establish his own geographical superiority.
Like a total character building. He frames himself as the, you know, the seasoned veteran of southern moisture.
The ultimate swamp dweller.
Right. Just looking down upon the fragile desert dwellers who cannot handle a slight uptick in the dew point.
It's so condescending, but so funny.
It is. And this dynamic reaches its absolute peak with his retelling of a rare Southern California rainstorm.
Oh, the storm. Yes.
He describes what was essentially a brief 5-minute drizzle accompanied by some heat lightning.
Right. Which in his normal life, that is just a standard Tuesday afternoon.
Barely even worth mentioning.
Exactly. But in Palm Springs, according to his vivid retelling anyway, it triggers a localized apocalypse.
Yeah. He claims this 5-minute sprinkle became the lead local news story the very next morning.
Lead story.
Yeah. He says the news anchors are dramatically showing footage of rain falling in front of car headlights.
Which is so dramatic.
And he swears that the second the rain started, actual emergency sirens began going off in the distance.
He paints this picture of total societal collapse over a passing shower.
It's incredible.
But I want to pause here for a second and ask you, the listener, to really think about the mechanics of this content.
Okay, let's unpack it.
Like, why do we care? Why would an audience tune in daily to hear a podcaster complain about 55% humidity in local weather reports?
Well, you care because it functions exactly like receiving a postcard from a friend who is notoriously difficult to please.
Oh, that is a perfect way to describe
it. Yeah, right. When you get that postcard, you aren't looking for a Wikipedia summary of the local monuments.
No, definitely not.
And you don't care about the official tourism statistics. You are entirely invested in your friend's inherently flawed, highly subjective perspective of the destination.
Yeah, you want the filter.
Exactly. He is taking a universal small talk topic, the weather, and using it as a narrative device to connect his southern roots to his temporary West Coast surroundings.
And while he's delivering this sarcastic monologue about sirens and chapped lips, there is a stark physical contrast happening right next to him.
Oh, Miss Kitty?
Yes. Sitting right there at that poolside table is his travel companion, Miss Kitty. But she is operating as a completely silent co-host.
Because she was not feeling well at all.
No, she wasn't. He notes that she refused to speak on the microphone, but he also broadcasts the intensely personal reason why.
Which he probably shouldn't have done.
Oh, he definitely shouldn't have. He tells everyone she is dealing with an upset tummy.
An upset tummy.
And then he later describes her condition with a level of graphic detail that we don't really need to fully repeat here.
No, let's skip the specific.
Yeah, let's just say it involves the imagery of a fire hydrant.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. But for now, she is just sitting there silently enduring gastrointestinal distress while he rants about the desert air.
Wow.
The juxtaposition of his loud performative broadcasting and her silent, miserable physical reality is incredibly engaging audio.
It really forces you to imagine sitting at that patio table with them.
Just trapped in this bizarre dynamic.
Trapped is the right word. But you know, that moment by the pool is just the warm-up, really.
Yeah, the real event is coming.
It transitions us into the true purpose of the trip, because the weather and the hotel, they're just the setting.
Right.
The actual narrative centerpiece, the entire reason the Goldfish Bowl was moved in the first place, is the physicalization of his digital community.
And this all culminates in the Saturday meet and greet.
Yes, an event officially termed the Hoot Nanny.
The Hoot Nanny.
It takes place in a venue called Hamburger Mary's, and it represents a profound shift in the archival history we are studying today.
And to truly understand the gravity of this Hoot Nanny, you have to look at the geographical logistics involved.
It wasn't easy back then.
Not at all. Again, this is not a modern era where you drop a pin in a group chat or, you know, coordinate via an Instagram story.
No, this is 2008.
Right. Coordinating a meetup of internet friends required navigating forums, direct messages, and a significant amount of logistical friction.
Oh, totally. So you have Nessa, who is the youngest member of the core group.
Right.
And big fatty notes, she drove 19 miles from San Diego.
Which, okay, anyone familiar with Southern California geography knows San Diego to Palm Springs is significantly farther than 19 miles.
Oh, absolutely. It is easily over a two-hour drive.
Yeah. But within the lore of the community, the distance is altered for comedic effect.
Exactly. She made a massive drive. But then you have Frank and Kevin.
Wait, who Big Fatty persistently refers to as Larry?
Yes. Proving that remembering secondary character names is entirely optional for him.
Completely optional.
So they are flying across the entire country from Atlanta. And then you have Tim and Ron, who also boarded a cross-country flight from Washington, D.C.
Which is just wild to think about. Purchasing a cross-country airline ticket, booking a hotel, and flying thousands of miles specifically to have a burger with a podcaster and some forum members.
It was a radical act of community building in 2008.
Truly radical. It proves that these daily 20-minute audio dispatches were not just passive entertainment.
No, the show had fostered a deeply tangible network. Big Fatty was no longer just a voice coming through an iPod cord.
He'd become the physical center of gravity for these people's social lives.
He really had.
But I have to admit, I struggle with this dynamic a bit, and I want to push back on how we frame it.
Okay, what do you mean?
Well, when they all finally gather at Hamburger Mary's, I don't see Big Fatty functioning as an equal participant in a warm group of friends.
No.
No. I see him acting as a highly exploitative casting director.
Ah, I see where you're going with this.
Right. He looks at these real people and instantly converts their private lives into fodder for his daily content machine.
He does tend to mine his relationships for material.
Heavily. Take Frank from Atlanta, for example. Big Fatty zeroes in on a highly specific physical detail about him.
The tattoo.
Yes. Frank has a large eagle tattoo on his back. And Big Fatty does not offer a polite compliment.
Definitely not polite.
Instead, he broadcasts an incredibly explicit admission that he, quote, wanted to lick on that for a little while.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And he follows that up by reporting that Frank's own husband labeled Frank with a derogatory term for a sex worker right there in the bar.
Right on the microphone.
Yeah. He is taking the private, slightly scandalous banter of a meetup and broadcasting it globally just to fill his 20-minute quota. It feels a bit predatory to me.
Well, that is a fair observation of the power dynamic. I'll give you that. Mm-hmm. But I would argue that framing it as purely exploitative kind of strips the participants of their own agency.
You think they knew what they were doing?
Oh, absolutely. What we are witnessing here is the very early stages of the clout economy.
Interesting.
The people who flew out to Palm Springs, they understood the mechanism of the Big Fatty online universe. They knew that by showing up, they were essentially auditioning to be characters in the narrative.
So they wanted the attention.
They wanted to be perceived. When Frank's husband makes that derogatory joke, he knows he's saying it in front of a man with a microphone.
So they're complicit.
Yes, the participants are completely complicit. They are willingly trading their privacy for a permanent spot in the community lore.
Huh. You think they are actively participating in their own fictionalization?
Precisely.
Yeah.
And the greatest example of this observational curation where reality meets performance is the lunch that takes place on Sunday.
Oh, at Sherman's Jewish Delicatessen.
Yes, Sherman's. He focuses his lens entirely on Miss Wes from the Leave It Up podcast.
Miss Wes.
And he provides this visceral, almost terrifying description of Wes's consumption speed.
It is legendary.
While the rest of the table is still just picking at their appetizers, Wes has already completely demolished a massive corned beef sandwich, a side of potato salad, and multiple glasses of iced tea.
Just inhaling the food.
Exactly. He paints Wes as this unstoppable culinary force of nature.
Yeah, you get this image of everyone else politely chewing, while Wes is just inhaling an entire deli counter.
But the defining character moment is the dessert order.
Oh, the dessert order is perfection.
despite everyone else at the table groaning about being way too full and literally begging the waitress not to bring the dessert menu,
Wes powers through.
He orders a huge slice of carrot cake.
And not just any slice.
Right. Wes looks the waitress dead in the eye and politely asks her to bring 5 forks so the whole table can share.
But as he says it, he gives the waitress a highly exaggerated, deliberate wink.
A huge wink.
Signaling to her that under no circumstances should she actually bring more than 1 fork.
He wants the entire cake for himself.
Obviously. But he wants the social credit of offering to share.
It's brilliant.
And by reporting that specific wink to the audience, Big Fatty captures the exact essence of his friend's personality.
He really does. And you know, in this digital universe, a character's absence can carry just as much narrative weight as their presence.
Oh, we have to talk about who wasn't there.
Yes. While we have these vivid descriptions of Wes and Frank, the narrative of the Hootenanny is also heavily defined by an anti-presence.
An anti-presence. I like that.
We must discuss the glaring absence of Auntie Vera and her husband, Goo.
Auntie Vera.
Auntie Vera lives in California. Out of everyone in the entire network, she was geographically the closest to Palm Springs.
The absolute closest.
Yet she is not at Hamburger Mary's. She is not at the deli.
And he actually plays the audio recording of her rejection on the show.
He does. And it's iconic.
It really is. When he asks her if she will be attending the Hootenanny, her response is just a wall of absolute denial.
The cadence is remarkable.
Yeah. She says, quote, "No. No, no, ma'am, no Siri, no."
Just absolute refusal.
Right. She isn't making a polite excuse about having other plans or being busy. She is actively, aggressively rejecting the physical manifestation of the community.
But here is the fascinating part. Ani Vera's refusal to participate physically doesn't distance her from the community.
It doesn't.
No, it actually cements her status as a foundational pillar of the lore.
Ah, because she's the holdout.
She becomes the ultimate holdout. In a network where people are willing to fly across the entire country and share deeply personal, often embarrassing details of their lives just to be part of the show.
Her firm boundary creates necessary friction.
Exactly. Big Fatty needs the tension of the people who say no just as much as he needs the enthusiasm of the people who show up.
That makes total sense. Her absence is processed and distributed as content just as effectively as Wes's carrot cake.
It truly is.
Well, we're going to pivot here because navigating the historical lore of a community this complex requires a certain level of rigorous accountability.
Oh, yes. It's time.
It is time for a dedicated space within our analysis. We are officially entering the Ruined Ruination segment.
In Ruined Ruination, we pause our thematic breakdown to explicitly correct the factual errors, misstatements, and stubborn historical inaccuracies that emerge from the archival audio.
Because there are always a few.
Maintaining the historical integrity of the source material is paramount, especially when the host himself actively fights against objective reality.
Yeah, Big Fatty has a notoriously combative relationship with facts.
That is putting it mildly.
Especially when it comes to pop culture. We have combed the archives for this specific week, and we need to address two distinct errors that highlight his unique brand of stubbornness.
Let's hear them.
So, the first is a matter of pronunciation. Throughout the archives, during his discussions of summer cinema, he consistently misidentifies the title of the massive 2008 Pixar animated film.
Oh, I know this one.
He insists repeatedly on calling it WALL-E.
WALL-E?
Yes. Putting a bizarre emphasis and separation on the syllables, completely ignoring the massive marketing campaign and cultural ubiquity of the correct pronunciation, WALL-E.
Right, the WALL-E mispronunciation is a classic example of his isolationist pop culture consumption.
Isolationist is a great word for it.
He absorbs media, sure, but he processes it entirely through his own internal phonetic filter, completely disregarding the external consensus.
If he thinks it's WALL-E, it's WALL-E.
Exactly. But the second correction is much more significant, as it deals with a major, long-running structural prediction he made on the show.
Oh, this is a big one.
For months, he had used his platform to confidently predict the winner of the 7th season of the reality television juggernaut American Idol.
American Idol was huge back then.
Huge. And he had staked his entire aesthetic reputation on the grand prediction that David Archuleta was going to take the crown.
He was entirely committed to Archuleta.
100%.
But objective reality intervened. And as history records, David Cook actually won the season.
David Cook took it.
So how does a host, whose entire brand is built on absolute, unfiltered confidence, handle being demonstrably publicly wrong about a massive cultural event.
It's a tough pivot.
Think about arguing with that one incredibly stubborn relative at a Thanksgiving dinner.
Oh, we all have one.
Right. You might present undeniable empirical proof that their fact is wrong, and they will look at that proof, shrug, and find a way to secure the final subjective word so that they still walk away feeling victorious.
That is exactly the psychological maneuver he employs here.
How does he do it?
Well, when he is forced by his audience to admit that David Cook won the competition, he does concede the objective fact.
He admits defeat.
Barely. He allows the reality of the vote to be stated on his show, but the very second he admits it, he subverts the loss by insisting that regardless of the trophy, David Archuleta is still, quote, cute as he can be.
Wow.
He breaks down the difference between a factual victory and an aesthetic victory.
So he loses the bet, but he wins the pageant in his mind.
Exactly. This maneuver defines his brand. Factual reality is strictly secondary to his personal aesthetic judgment.
Unbelievable.
If reality doesn't align with his preferences, reality is simply dismissed as having bad taste.
Reality is wrong.
Right. Admitting he was wrong about the winner, but refusing to back down on his personal preference, proves to the listener that his opinions cannot be bought or swayed by a popular vote. His worldview is completely impenetrable.
Which brings us to the geographical and psychological whiplash of our next transition.
The vacation is over.
The vacation cannot last forever. We have to examine the transition back to the real world.
It's always a tough transition.
We move from the sun-drenched, unscripted luxury of the Palm Springs trip directly back to the oppressive, structured reality of what he ominously calls the coal mine.
The coal mine.
And by extension, the return to the fat cave.
Right.
The psychological shift is palpable. I mean, he has traded the ambient, chaotic noise of the poolside for the absolute contained silence of his home studio.
And that return to the fat cave requires an immediate reestablishment of the technical baseline.
The goldfish is back in its proper bowl.
Yes, and the filter needs to be turned on. He explicitly details the abandonment of the raw poolside audio.
Thank goodness.
Right. He announces the triumphant return of the snowflake microphone and mentions that he is testing out a brand new pair of Apple earbuds.
Now, we need to clarify this for younger listeners.
Yes, remember, in 2008, these were the iconic wired white earbuds that came with an iPod, not the wireless tech we have today.
Oh, those tangled wires.
Exactly. But he doesn't just inform the audience of these technical adjustments. He actively weaponizes them to reestablish his dominance over the listener.
He does. He gives them a blunt warning about the audio quality.
What does he say?
He says that if the listeners don't like the sound of the snowflake mic and the new earbuds, they might, quote, get the finger and have to effing get used to it.
Good grief.
I know. He isn't asking for constructive feedback on his audio engineering. He is laying down a dictatorial mandate.
My way or the highway.
You will listen to the audio as I present it, or you can leave.
It's so funny because most creators beg for patience and apologize for technical issues.
Oh, constantly apologizing.
But Big Fatty uses the threat of poor audio quality as a loyalty test.
A loyalty test?
Yes. If you are truly dedicated to the content, you will endure whatever acoustic setup he decides to broadcast.
You'll suffer through it.
But once the technical threats are issued, a much larger problem emerges.
What's that?
He has to actually fill the 20-minute void.
Ah, the content problem.
Right. Without the organic chaos of missing luggage, cross-country flights, and friends eating massive deli sandwiches, what sustains the content engine?
That is where we must unpack the absolute necessity of the reality TV calendar.
The reality TV calendar.
It is the structural spine of his domestic life. When his own life lacks the unscripted chaos of a vacation, the highly structured, manufactured drama of reality television steps in to fill the void.
It's a perfect substitute.
It is. And to understand why this was so critical in 2008, you have to remember how daily podcasting functioned back then.
It was a very different landscape.
There was no endless scroll of TikToks to react to. If you had to talk for 20 minutes a day, every single day, you needed a reliable external narrative engine.
You couldn't just invent drama out of thin air every day.
Right. So the advent of DVR technology, like TiVo, allowed him to stockpile these narratives and deploy them when his own life was too quiet.
Brilliant.
He immediately dives back into what he calls his quiz programs.
It is a meticulously curated schedule of observation.
Truly.
He provides urgent updates on Big Brother 9.
Oh, Big Brother.
Specifically focusing on the power dynamics in the house. He details how 75-year-old Jerry won the head of household competition.
Good for Jerry.
And immediately used that power to nominate Jesse, the arrogant, muscular bodybuilder.
The big fatty absolutely loved.
Oh, he relished it. But he doesn't stop at Big Brother. He rackedly fires through his viewing schedule.
What else is on the docket?
He is tracking the new season of Project Runway, specifically noting its high population of homosexuals. He has an episode of The Baby Borrowers queued up. He recorded Great American Dog.
Great American Dog. I forgot about that one.
And he and his co-workers at the coal mine are collectively obsessing over the physical comedy of the giant red balls on the obstacle course show Wipeout.
Okay, I want you to really reflect on this for a second because it's wild.
What is?
Why is a podcaster's summary of a reality show that aired on national television so magnetic?
That's a good question.
I mean, a show that you can easily just watch yourself. Why does an audience tune in to hear a man from South Carolina list the shows he recorded on his DVR?
It seems counterintuitive.
The answer is that the audience is not tuning in for the facts of the episode. They were tuning in entirely for the filter.
Yes. The filter is everything.
They don't want to know who won Wipeout.
Yeah.
They want to know how Big Fatty reacted to someone falling off a giant rubber ball.
They want his commentary.
Exactly. They want his specific judgmental lens applied to the mundane cultural touchstones of the era.
He acts as the ultimate designated viewer.
Designated viewer, I love that.
Think about it. The reality TV landscape in 2008 was a bloated swamp of programming resulting from the recent writer's strike.
Oh, right. The writer's strike caused a massive boom in reality shows.
Exactly. He wades through that swamp so his audience doesn't have to, extracting only the narratives and the character archetypes that fit his worldview.
He curates the trash.
He packages their television watching for them.
Which brings us to the final days of our week, where the routine is fully, irrevocably reestablished.
Back to normal.
Vacation is a memory, the reality TV calendar is operational, and the daily grind enters its purest, most stable form of domestic operation.
Which means it's time for the deep cuts.
Oh, yeah. The final segment leans heavily into nostalgia, community logistics, and celestial excuses.
Celestial excuses.
Yes. He kicks off the Friday broadcast with his legendary Memory Lane music segment. This is where he essentially tests the cultural literacy of his audience. He plays the theme from The Jetsons.
The Jetsons.
But he doesn't just play the song and give the answer. He provides a highly specific, slightly obscure clue.
And the clue is?
Sprockets and Cogs.
Ah! The Sprockets and Cogs reference is a very specific piece of audio trivia.
Very specific.
Because Spacely Space Sprockets and Cogswell's Cogs were the rival companies in the show.
Right.
By using this as the clue, he isn't just asking if you recognize the melody. He is testing whether you understand the fundamental corporate lore of a 1960s Hanna-Barbera cartoon.
It's a joyful gatekeeping mechanism.
It really is. It establishes a shared cultural baseline.
Yep.
If you know about Mr. Spacely and Mr. Cogswell, you belong in his community.
But the segment that perfectly encapsulates the bizarre dynamic between Big Fatty and his listeners is the discussion of the point system.
Oh, the point system. This is unbelievable.
We have to break down the logistics of this fandom because it borders on a transactional administrative state.
It really does.
He details an interaction with a listener named Miss Kathy, who has been dutifully clipping and sending him Pepsi points.
Cutting them out by hand.
Right. But it doesn't stop at soda. He then outlines his rigid, incredibly complicated demands for listeners to send him rebate points from bags of 8 o'clock coffee.
The transactional nature of this relationship is staggering when you compare it to modern creator economies.
Oh, night and day.
Today, a creator sets up a Patreon, a fan clicks a button, and $5 is transferred digitally.
Instantly.
Instantly. But in 2008, he relied on his audience to actively, physically subsidize his mundane grocery habits.
He is asking a global digital community to act as his personal coupon clipping administrative support team.
Yes. And he even complains about how hard it is. He compares the convoluted process of mailing in these coffee points to a bizarre scavenger hunt.
What was the analogy he used?
He says it's as complicated as taking a paper bag into a hardware store and trying to fill it with a specific ratio of PVC pipe and heavy chains just to get a discount.
That is so absurd.
He knows the system is broken. He knows it's a massive hassle, but he demands that his listeners navigate the hassle for his benefit anyway.
And they actually do it.
They do.
They cut out the barcodes, put them in envelopes, and mail them to South Carolina so he can save a few dollars on his morning brew.
It is the ultimate flex of parasocial power.
It really is. He has monetized their affection through the literal subsidization of his caffeine intake.
Unbelievable.
But how does he get away with his demanding, chaotic behavior without alienating everyone?
Well, he employs an unarguable defense mechanism.
The celestial excuse.
Exactly. He looked at the calendar, notes the lunar cycle, and explicitly blames any erratic behavior, any missing show notes, or any demanding rants on the fact that it's a full moon day.
The great, great full moon.
Yes. By blaming the moon, he absolves himself of any organizational responsibility.
It's genius, really.
It is. If the show goes off the rails, if he demands too many coffee points, it is simply the gravitational pull of the moon acting upon the tides of his universe.
Nothing he can do about it.
Right. It is a comedic safety net that allows him to lean fully into the most demanding aspects of his persona without losing the affection of the audience.
Wow. Let's pull all of this together. We have tracked this incredibly dense week from the poolside in Palm Springs back to the depths of the Fat Cave.
We covered a lot of ground.
We did. So what is the ultimate takeaway from these 5 days of audio?
The synthesis of this week is a testament to the absolute durability of his formula.
His strict, unwavering formula.
Yes. We watched him execute a flawless transition. He took the unscripted, highly unpredictable sensory chaos of a physical meetup.
Right, the desert humidity, the eagle tattoos, the 5-4 carrot cake.
And he seamlessly processed that energy back into the rigid, comforting complaints of his daily domestic life.
He turned it all into content.
Exactly. He proved that the content isn't dependent on the location. The content is entirely dependent on his unwavering commitment to his own perspective.
The goldfish survived the nightclub and returned to the quiet living room without ever changing its swimming pattern.
Beautifully said.
And that leaves us with a final thought for you to mull over as you go about your own week.
Okay, what is it?
Well, Big Fatty took his most utterly mundane annoyances. The feeling of 55% humidity on his lips, the speed at which a friend eats a corned beef sandwich, the frustrating bureaucracy of a coffee rebate program.
All very minor things.
Yes. And he transformed those annoyances into sticky, community-building narrative art. He built an empire on the back of his own minor inconveniences.
He really did.
So think about your own life. What incredibly boring, repetitive, seemingly invisible aspect of your own daily routine. The commute you hate, the coworker who talks too loud, the specific way your refrigerator hums could become compelling narrative art if you simply presented it to the world with absolute unfiltered confidence. I am King.
And I am Gail.
Yeah, we want to thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the source material.
Pleasure.
Be sure to tune in next weekend for the newest episode of Ruination, The Early Years. We will see you then.
Well, we hope you enjoyed today's trip down memory lane on Ruination, The Early Years. Join us again next weekend. We'll see you then.